up again a little later on. The daylight raids. And I'm moving now into August and August.
We can hang on to that.
All right,
one, sir.
All right.
One other thing. Now, what were your target areas basically through the month of May, June? I was thinking of preparation for Normandy and things, and what effect that had on your particular squadron.
Yeah, well, I mentioned in May we had our squadron continue to do a great deal of gardening. I see we were going for rail centers in Belgium, which very clearly relate now to the to the bombing pattern as we understand it.
Was there any feeling about dropping bombs, say, in Belgium or France, worrying about civilian casualties?
You were specifically briefed to. You were told, for instance, that you were bombing a rail center on the north side of Gand or Brussels or whatever, that the city was on your left or right or wherever as you went in, that if you to be particularly careful in your bombing run, to really strive for maximum accuracy here. Don't do anything. No wild maneuvers. Make sure you're straight and level and so on. And if for any reason you had a bomb release malfunction, whereas in Germany you could just pull a master release device and drop the whole load. You were specifically ordered not to do that in operations over any of the occupied countries. So those were specific instructions. And there's no question about it. We were
different attitude.
Different attitude. We were a lot more sensitive to the risks on the ground if we didn't perform in a pretty precise way.
But the precision bombing in the Lancashire, you're talking about a 5 mile pattern at times, or it can be. Is that not correct, sir?
I don't think a 5 mile pattern.
That's too much.
Too much.
But within a couple of miles, though, is that not correct?
Yeah, I suppose flying. Well, I'd have to work it out again. If you were dropping, say, 10 or 12 1,000-pounders, you were dropping that, and there'd be a specific interval between release of a bomb or sets of bombs, and the bombs dropped from the bomb racks in a manner that allowed the weight and balance of the aircraft to be such that that the aircraft wouldn't be forced into a violent maneuver during the bomb release period. So you're, let's say you're flying at 150 miles per hour at altitude, you're 15,000 feet. You could get rid of all of your bombs in about, well, less than 10 seconds. They were dropping off very quickly. Now you'll have to do the arithmetic, but I don't think you're looking at more than perhaps a mile, maybe a mile and a half on the ground. You were dropping at a specific airspeed as well, of course.
Mm-hmm.
When you were flying in close to occupied territory and occupied cities, you were tracked in a way, hopefully, that if you undershot. You weren't undershooting, say, in the heart of Brussels, or if you were overshooting, you weren't overshooting into North Paris. The attempt was to give as much protection to the ground as you could with this pretty imprecise machine. There's no question about it. We call it precision bombing, but compared to smart bombing of today, where you know. They were talking pickle barrels in those days. Well, it was the biggest damn pickle barrel that I ever did not see. You were scattering bombs over a fair pattern, but the attempt visibly, and we were told why you were tracking in that way very often.
What about this undershooting business? I know General Lane talked about it with Pathfinders, because like they would go in and lay the target markers. And I guess through eagerness, exuberance, adrenaline, all these other factors. People get trigger happy in that they were dropping, and you could watch this whole pattern, you know, foreshooting, and they kept getting away from the
target indicators.
The target indicators.
Yeah.
Now, there was, I know Pathfinders had different ways of getting around it. Sometimes they overshot the target on purpose, others, this type of thing. But did you have any recollections about undershooting targets? I'm thinking the undershooting more than the overshooting itself.
Well, the only reason you'd undershoot would be an eagerness to get rid of your to get rid of your load and get out. You know that when Pathfinders dropped their target indicators, they were down low enough so they could see pretty well on the. You know, I've dropped it on the corner of Portage and Main, and we really want to bomb five blocks over. They were able to, for the most part, identify exactly where their TIs were, and then of course they tried to run the raid in relation to the center of that cluster of target indicators, and you'd hear the master bomber say. Large cluster of yellows or large cluster of reds, and from an altitude you could probably identify it. In the early stages of the raid, once the fires got going, it became increasingly difficult to identify color down there. You'd hear him say, bomb to the left, or bomb short of, or bomb beyond, whatever his target indicator point of reference was. And he tried to move the raid around the target in relation to his target indicator. And I said, well, that was a pretty imprecise method, because to a bomber crew, bomb 500 feet short of that center of target indicators
coming off getting the center a little.
No, bit. Yeah, it didn't mean a hell of a lot, but you tried. You know, you tried. If your bomb aimer would say, okay, skipper, I'm going to release just a little short. He'd be tracking along with his bomb sight, and he could see the center of the yellows or whatever the target indicator colors were that night. And it would have been his intention to bomb on the center, and if he got word from the master bomber, the bomb aimer was listening out to the master bomber as well, of course. If he got instructions to bomb to the left, the right, or beyond, he would certainly try and do it. I mentioned before that if the aircraft was not straight and level, wings level and fore and aft level as well, that as your bombs released, if you weren't level, they did scatter. There's no question about it. You could roll them off to one side very, very easily indeed. So the imprecision, the shortfalls would be, to my knowledge, more a result of that than to any over-eagerness or fear or panic. Mind you, if as you were on your target run and you got hit, I think the natural tendency would be to they like you, don't they?
Oh yeah, I gotta get away with bees.
The tendency might well be to get rid of your load and get out. But as a practice, I don't think.
Okay, I got another couple of crummy ones to ask in a bit, but we'll leave them for now. What about these targets again now? You did a lot of mining, or gardening as you called it, prior to Normandy. You did the marshalling yards in Belgium and some in northern France. What about the flying bomb sites, the V1 sites?
Yeah, I see we hit a few of those.
What were they like to go after?
We did those... We tended to do those in daylight now.
That'd be looking for the big T, I guess, eh?
The launch...
the launch platform would be a large
launch platform. I see in July we went after a place called La Haye. And I see here doodle bug site. I see in August we did a buzz bomb site at a place called Toulon-Villet.
Now you use the terms doodle bug and buzz bomb synonymous, right? V1?
V1.
Yeah.
V1. Although, and I can't seem to identify it here. At one point in time, we went after V2 as well, but I don't see it identified particularly.
That wouldn't be up at Peenemunde, would it?
No, these were V2s. These were V2 launch sites right in Belgium and France.
Now, this continued on right through June and into July, into France basically, or were you hitting Germany as well?
Yeah, I see. In July we were after Stuttgart on two consecutive nights.
How long would it take you to get to Stuttgart? There you have your figures.
Yeah, between 9 and 10 hours.
10 hour flight.
That's from engines on to engines off, essentially.
And what, you'd form up over the channel type of thing, or would
these were night raids, so mm-hmm. there was no forming up.
It'd be a gaggle,
you'd gaggle, and as you left the coast the English coast at last light, you had a precise turning point before you started your run into northern France. I recall these in July. You see, they were a pretty short night in July. I recall coming out on both of these Stuttgart raids that we were in well into the light of early dawn, still in around Paris somewhere, and we felt damn vulnerable. The tactics on both these occasions was to come out low, like 1,000 feet above the ground.
In daylight, or in early morning light.
Early morning light. The raid itself would be in darkness.
What about July now? Were you doing any, I'm thinking July and August, the Allied forces had secured their beachhead and were moving inland, and I was thinking of places like Caen and Verrières and all these types of things. Were you going into support?
Yeah, I see in August 14th, we were on Falaise. This was the Falaise Gap.
Now, would you be bombing the pocket itself?
We that certainly was the intention. That that Falaise thing was a bit of a schmozzle, as you recall. It was a daylight raid. With fighter cover, so it was a so-called daylight gaggle, and I don't think Bomber Command exactly distinguished itself with bombing accuracy on that particular occasion. We were impeccable at all other times. Of course, but on that particular occasion, we scattered. I remember this attack particularly because in the briefing, it was going to be as it was
going
to be.
Do you have a date in that there, sir?
I make it 14 August.
Mm-hmm.
In a Lank 10.
The operation tractable, I guess, 14 August.
9,000 feet, mm-hmm. And the instruction was it had to be precise. The targets were going to be extremely well marked. There was very much an invasion force bomb line, short of which you simply were not to drop under any circumstances.
Now, would you be directed by colored smoke or pathfinders?
We had pathfinders. We had target indicators, a combination of bright. I forgot. I think the color was yellow. As it subsequently turned out, the color of the day on the ground was yellow as red. As well, so that was a built-in confusion that we weren't aware of.
Orange ring the bell?
Don't recall. It could have been orange, and perhaps looking like red, or looking like yellow. But the other instruction was, if you had any doubt as to the serviceability of your bomb site, you were to bring the bombs back and either land with them or dump them in a dump bomb area. Because if there was any errors, we'd be hitting our own troops. But it was a very well marked track in. We crossed a given river and a given island in the river, and a timed run from this, and then pick up your target indicators and bomb. I remember the as we tracked him, my bomb aimer suddenly said, "Ah," in strong words, "this bloody sight is unserviceable." Mm-hmm. In the automatic gyroscopic mode, you could use the bomb sight so-called manually, but for greater accuracy, you wanted everything working on it. And we were very much set in our bombing run pattern. We still had about 3 or 4 minutes to go, and the bomb aimer said, "This bloody thing is unserviceable." And I said, I can't remember precisely what I said, but I said, "Bomb aimer, you think you can handle it manually? Do you know exactly where you are?" He had a map up front as well, and the navigator was sitting up beside me doing a visual track-in as well. And he said, "Yes, I can, Skipper, but do you remember the briefing?" And I said, "To hell with the briefing. If you know exactly where you are..." He was the top bomb aimer of the squadron. He was the section leader of all bomb aimers on 428. And I said, "To hell with that. You operated this thing manually." Not in so many words at the time, but I got the impression across. "If you are happy, I'm prepared to take the risk."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "I can do it."
So what altitude were you?
9,000 feet, but right. A beautiful clear day. On top, down below, it was absolute mayhem. And we could see aircraft ahead of us, and then later behind us, bombing well short. And we knew there was trouble. But I said, "Okay, bomb aimer, you know, track in, take on." And then he directed me, "Left, left, right, right, steady, steady, steady. Ready to, you know, I'm bombing in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, now go." Down they went. And we took a picture. As it turned out, a hell of a good picture. But we could see the raid was not going well. We knew the bombs were falling far, far too short. We knew instinctively they were falling on our troops.
Okay, now the thing is that they were falling short. What explanation, if any?
Color.
It was the confusion of this smoke.
Confusion of smoke, confusion of target indicators. But we knew ourselves immediately then that there certainly was confusion of smoke, but there should not have been any confusion in terms of the
bombing run itself.
The bombing run, because we knew that from that island, from that intersection, from so on, there were so many miles to go before we came to what was considered the target area. And we tracked in visually and knew precisely where we were. Now, finally, I vaguely remember saying, "Okay, the aircraft is now over our bomb line, where we had been briefed it would be. Therefore, any bombs being released now are going to go ahead beyond the bomb line." There was no danger of a mistake of shortfall. In any event, we knew something was seriously amiss. Flew back. That was a 4-hour and 50-minute attack, in fact, or operation for us from Middleton St. George.
Was there lots of conjecture on the way back?
On the way back, I would have to admit I had a long chat with the crew and said, "Now, look, our bomb sight was okay. It went unserviceable after that. The bomb aimer and I are absolutely satisfied, and the navigator, that we did not bomb short. So when you land, shut up. I'll do the talking." We landed, and each aircraft was met immediately. The word was back now, of course. We were still, the raid had taken place, and we flew back 2 hours worth up England, landed.
Yeah, the actual target you have is right at Falaise.
Well, I simply say I see Falaise here, equipment, and clearly we're going for a concentration of German equipment, probably armor, concentrated around the Falaise Gap. I suppose they were concentrating for the subsequent breakout. So when we landed, we were met immediately. The cameras was immediately removed and rushed in, and I was taken. I think we were met by the station commander on that occasion, and I was a flight commander by now in 428 squadron. And he said, "What can you tell me? What happened? You know, we're getting flak from 6th Group and Bomber Command, the thing's a bloody mess. What happened? Well, I had an immediate wave of apprehension because I knew what we had done, and we had broken the briefing instruction with confidence in our own ability to do it manually. And he said, "Their heads are going to fall on this one." And sure enough, our picture came out. It was maybe the best picture we ever took, and we were bang on. We were right on the concentration. Great sigh of relief. No explanation needed from me. And I didn't volunteer anything. I didn't volunteer a damn thing.
What about the rest of the crew? Any leakage there, or were they terrified enough?
They knew. No, the only people that were the flight engineer, the two gunners were out of it. They nothing would have happened there. But the navigator, the bomb hammer, and the skipper were the guys that would have.
But everyone in the crew knew that you thought
Oh yeah.
Everyone was keeping pretty close to the vest, pretty tight.
Yeah, everyone was standing around very somberly.
Well, what happened then? You were met, your picture was taken, your picture, you were cleared, so then what? No, we weren't.
The sequence was I was met immediately, and as the flight commander was asked to explain what the hell went on, and I gave my verbal, oral version, just as I've given it to you, that we felt they were bombing awfully short. There seemed to be great confusion on the colors on which we were supposed to bomb, but I made a point of saying that we tracked in visually and we did a timed run and we knew exactly where we were at all times. And I think I remember saying, and as far as I know, we were in the middle of the target, and stopped right then. Then we went into station commander rushed off to meet other aircraft still landing, trying to get his picture straight. Then we went into the normal debriefing by the intelligence staff. By now, my picture had been developed, and I saw it on the table and looked at it very, very quickly and could see that we were home free. So I didn't. I reported. As was the custom, any equipment and serviceability of an operational type. This would be your H2S, your G, or your bomb site. And I said, as we tracked back home, we tested the bomb site again, and we think it's unserviceable. End of conversation about bomb site. But I suppose looking back, I obviously disobeyed a sensible order, but we had such confidence in our crew, the individual members of the crew. I was so satisfied from the navigator and bomb hammer that we knew where we were, and we knew bomb fall direction and pattern. We went ahead and did it. It was a hell of a bore hauling your bombs all the way home.
Well, what about others in the squadron itself who came up short and whose pictures didn't verify or come out, and there was discrepancy? Do you recall the flak afterwards?
Yeah. Seems to me that on that raid, the squadron commander had not flown that day, so he essentially was absolved, although he was responsible for the conduct of his crews. That both there were two flight commanders, and both of us were on the raid, and both of us okay. The other flight commander was a fellow named Gagno. He had a good picture as well. The one or two crews had questionable ones, but by and large, I seem to recall that 428 came out okay on this one. That we had bombed beyond the bomb line, and I don't recall any heads rolling on that one.
What was the general feeling, though, around the mess concerning hitting your own?
Well,
not that you guys had, but that,
no,
that
no,
your
well, great,
the air.
You know, a sense of frustration and anger. How could anybody be so bloody stupid as to bomb short of the bomb line after the kind of briefing we had? Anger, and we didn't, of course, there were no published There was no intelligence that we had immediate access to, and there was nothing in the papers about it, of course, because this was classified stuff. Blowing the hell out of the sharp edge of our attack force, I gather. My army friends subsequently raised this raid on a number of occasions, and they were less than complimentary. But to return to what was going on in the month of August, that was the only...
Now, you'd been promoted to squadron leader.
Yeah, I was now a flight commander.
Mm-hmm.
I was now a flight commander in August. And the other raids, I was on five others. They were in all in Germany. Brunswick a couple of times, Stettin twice, and Bremen. So that month, I had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I was on seven operations, seven raids, and five of those were deep in Germany. Stettin, you may recall, is way over in the old East Prussian area.
Mm-hmm.
Brunswick Central and Bremen on the coast. And why?
Was there a change after the invasion of, I guess, of...
Well, I'm looking exclusively at one squadron's operation.
Mm-hmm.
Although this probably reflected what the base was doing. Both squadrons were probably on this pattern. And
I was thinking that the German defenses, was there a change? Did they become more tenacious, less? Do you notice any difference at all?
I don't recall any particular difference. No, they were long. I see the one to Stettin went 9 hours and 45 minutes, 10 hours of flying, which is
long time.
Which was a long time on those aircraft.
What about what was the target actual? Target things that you were after, say, it's the teen or the dark matter, was it just a question of raising hell in the city or what?
I couldn't tell you now why Stettin at that point in time, although, of course, the Russian thrust was gaining momentum, and I don't know where the Russians were. We would have had it on our maps. We would have known where the Russians were from our briefing maps. But it could be that it was some attempt at disrupting lines of communications leading east to the Russian battle zone.
There was no, this may sound silly now, but there was no thought at times that you should load up with twice the bombs and continue on through your pattern and land in Russia, refuel, and come back.
That in fact was done, as you know. But in our case, no, we'd never done that.
I was just thinking of a cooperation between, because it almost seems that, I mean, my God, if you're going to go 5 hours out and then 5 hours back and right over the heart of resistance,
yeah,
that it would almost seem, you know, to make a layover, if you will.
I don't know what the capability of the Russian airfields would have been to receive. A flock of Lancaster was a great gaggle of ground equipment that went mm-hmm. With any operation like this.
The supplies were very hard.
And I don't know if the bomb lugs would have matched, et cetera, et cetera.
Logistically not possible, probably.
Well, I don't know, but I suspect there were enormous problems there.
Did you ever tie up with the Russian Air Force?
Never did. Didn't as far as we know, we weren't near them.
Now this continued on like basically in August. Now how long did you remain with the squadron? Now you went to 420 squadron later. Now is that not correct, sir?
Yeah, I.
You're promoted and.
Yeah, I flew my last operation with 428. In October 6th, against Dortmund, and then moved to take over 420 Squadron down at Talthorpe in southern Yorkshire. And I see that I took over 420 on the 17th of October, 1944.
Okay.
And these were... Do you mind not dragging them over here?
Sorry about that. Guess we've got a love lost for wasps or bees.
They're very aggressive.
Yes, I see that.
Buzz off there.
The thing is, sir, is that you stay with 428 Squadron until October.
Yep.
And so for the month of August, for the months of July, August, and September...
September.
Where your basic raids were... The Falaise is the major one with cooperation with the ground forces, and other than that, it was strictly regular bomber command. Is that correct?
Regular day and night bomber command.
But the only actual cooperation, however you want to phrase it, between land forces and you in a combined effort was only at the Falaise thing in your case. Is that
well,
correct?
Except I see we attacked on the 10th of September at daylight. Le Havre, and it seems to me that Le Havre was surrounded by them, or cut off, so that would be a form of, quote, cooperation. And then on the 28th of September, we attacked another daylight, Cap Grenet.
Cape Grenet, yeah.
Yeah.
The gun batteries there.
And that obviously had a flavor of cooperation.
General
well.
Rockingham was.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But this was interspersed then with raids on Kiel and Dortmund. And I repeat, I left...
You have no recollection of Cape Grenet or
no,
these others?
No.
The only one you recollect is Falaise, is that correct?
For obvious reasons.
Yeah.
It was a bad day. And we knew it. Well, my last operation period was on the 6th of October 1944 on Dortmund. I then was selected. I think I mentioned to you being in 1944 October, I was the ripe age of 23 on October the 4th. And it must have been sometime after the 6th that I was ordered to appear before the AOC of 6th Group, Black Mike McEwen, and it subsequently transpired in company with three or four other squadron leaders, and we were being looked over as squadron commanders by the AOC of 6th Group and his staff. And I knew by about October 9th, that I had been selected because I was instructed to proceed to...
Getting a ring on your uniform? Or
not yet, no, but I was instructed to proceed to Topcliffe for a very short conversion course. It turned out to be a two-day conversion course onto the Halifax 3. Converted in
back.
2 days.
You went backwards there. You took three sideways, eh?
3 hours and 40 minutes conversion, and I was now the CO of 420. I think probably about the 15th of October. Where does it show here? 17th of October, CO of 420. But instructed. I was CO, but I was instructed not to go on any operations.
Yeah.
And it
promoted to wing commander.
I was promoted to wing commander. Honor about the 15, 16, 17 of October. Took over the squadron, but told not to operate. And protested bitterly, probably as much as a matter of form as anything. You know, you were expected to be an aggressive operational type, but I remember being very disappointed. I wanted to fly the Halifax on ops, and clearly it had something to do with the loss of squadron commanders and experienced senior wing commander operational people, staff, COs, air staff, or whatever.
And you would be considered senior at 23 years old.
At 23, I was, I had a tour of some, 35, 40 missions behind me. I was quite experienced.
You're an old man of the woods, eh?
Old man. I had been a flight commander for all of 3 months, 3.5 months. I had undertaken briefings, so my air and ground performance was pretty well assessed. And of course, I was enormously confident. I was sure I should have been made at least chief of
air staff. Eh?
Chief of air staff at that point in time. No, in fact, that you wondered what the hell was going on. I'd been a flight lieutenant. I arrived on the squadron in March. As a flying officer, and what am I talking now? And that was late March as a flying officer. So April, May, June, July, August, September, October, 5-6 months. I'd been made a
from a second Louis to a half colonel.
To a half colonel, and was rather marveled at it, but felt I could handle it.
Only proper.
I'd heard some pretty lousy briefings and figured I could do at least twice as well as that. So it wasn't. I wasn't in shock.
Oh, I find it funny.
You find that age.
I can handle it.
Now, mind you, you know what our responsibilities were. They were nothing like a peacetime CO, if you like. Terms of administrative responsibilities. You were the image. You had to project.
Getting no scarf, eh?
No scarf. Hell no. Bomber command didn't wear. We were producers. We weren't the glamour guys. You projected an image of knowing what the hell you were doing, and
I just find it difficult in that. I guess half the wing commanders weren't even shaving then. Is that correct, sir?
Not correct.
Not correct. They were shaving it.
Oh, yeah. Most of us started to shave at 18 or 19. Very few 18, 19-year-old wing commanders. None, as far as I know. in our force, anyway.
Oh,
but I repeat your responsibilities, looking back, well, they weighed very, very heavily on you at 23. You were required to project the image of professional knowledge and confidence. You didn't have to demonstrate the experience.
But how could you look the old sergeants in the eye? I guess this is the thing that I. Or you wouldn't have old sergeants.
You had some, and you listened to them very, very carefully. Yeah, I had imaginant, lieutenant on 420, who must have been pretty close to twice my age. He would be in his late 30s, early 40s. And
he's calling you sir and meant it, right?
Calling me sir, and he'd better mean it. But I turned to him with every administrative problem. I'd had no administrative experience at that point in time. Everything had been operational. Briefings, preparation of syllabus.
What they do in the Army is you're made half colonel, and you're immediately sent to staff college. Just not the case in the Air Force.
Well, certainly
during
not
this time.
Certainly not the case in wartime for us. Heavens no. They say there wasn't a pool of even then, we're now late 44. There was no glut of senior experience. I was given one short administrative course. It was a junior air staff course at Cranwell that lasted, I think, about a week. That suggested that this was the way to write a letter. I still hadn't written a letter. I knew nothing about appreciations. I understood tactics. I understood targeting. I understood
how to fly a plane.
I understood how to fly an airplane. I knew, based on my exposure to earlier COs, what seemed to make a good squadron go. So I happily stepped into this position with some apprehension. Yeah, you wonder if you were going to make a nonsense of it, but you didn't really believe you would. And
well, that's true. And there's no one else to.
And there was
no one else to take your place anyway.
There was no one else.
Well, I think we got pretty good today. Next day, right. If I can, I will pick up with your promotion, and you're taking over of 420 Squadron in the Halifaxes.
Which was a very brief period.
But still, we'll pick that up and try to pick off the war. Thank you very much, sir.